Hello and welcome to another episode of the Inside R&E podcast. I'm your host for today, Devin Kosar. I'm a member of the firm's litigation department and head of the violations department at R&E. Additionally, my practice includes matters related to construction law, condo co-op law, landlord-tenant issues, and commercial litigation. On today's episode, we'll be talking about the Climate Mobilization Act, or Local Law 97. Local Law 97 was enacted in the beginning of 2019 and quietly snuck up on people as the city was just kind of coming out of COVID. The goal is to ambitiously reduce greenhouse gas emissions in New York City. Local Law 97 has been in the works for some time, and after much deliberation and consternation, it's here. As we'll discuss today, there are some very important deadlines that may affect many of our listeners today. My guest for today's episode is Alex Zaffron, Director of Business Development of Logical Buildings, where he partners with real estate owners and managers nationwide to cut energy costs, enhance efficiency, and lower their carbon footprint. Alex's expertise span across various sectors, including energy commodities, financial markets, energy procurement, solar generation, and smart buildings technology. His insights on New York City's energy landscapes for co-ops and condos have been featured in Habitat, Brick Underground, The Cooperator, and many industry publications. For buildings subject to Local Law 97, Alex's primary goal is to eliminate the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that many are feeling right now and replace it with a clear plan of action. Alex, welcome to the show.
Devin, thanks so much for having me.
And we're lucky to have you. I think you've been making the rounds talking about this very important topic. And, you know, for our clients and our audience here, we want to dive in this a little bit more today. Because I think, as you and I have talked, and as you've stated, energy isn't the first thing on people's minds, right? So as we'll touch upon today, it's going to be immensely important in the near term and long term future. But you didn't start out in the real estate field, right? So why don't you tell us a little bit, how did you get involved in this area and specifically the energy efficiency field?
Well, first of all, thank you, Devin, and thanks to the whole Rosenberg and Estes team for having me. You know, life is sometimes a combination of taking steps that don't necessarily seem to have a connection to one another, but just following that path, and it's the fun of life when you see where it ends up. Sure. So I started off, you know, in the world of energy from a financial standpoint at Bloomberg, and I was thinking about where I was working on energy at a macro level, supporting financial institutions with their investments in energy. But I didn't really understand what it meant at the micro level, meaning you're advising these large, anyone from institutional investor to hedge funds to government organizations about energy, but you don't necessarily, or I didn't necessarily know at the time how it was being used. I got introduced to the world of energy for real estate, and I was hooked. You know, there's a saying in real estate that every building is like a snowflake, because they're all different. They've got you know, different bones, certainly different personalities to the administration and to the boards, and different challenges. But they want the same thing. Every building in the energy space wants to be able to use less energy and save on costs. The fundamental problem is that you can't really fix what you can't measure. Right. And when I got introduced to that that challenge in the energy world for real estate, it showed me that this was a problem that wasn't going to go away. As an anecdote, you know, I grew up in Florida, where it wasn't uncommon for as a child for us to have days off from hurricanes. I know in the Northeast, you guys may have had snow days. We had hurricane days where you'd wake up and see what happened outside your window. And it just taught me that energy usage is one of those things that you're not thinking about, but then when you don't have electricity, and mind you, this was in the era before smartphones and laptops, when you don't have electricity, then you're thinking about it and it's all you can think about. And I think that's where we find ourselves right now at the crossroads of New York and Local Law 97.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, you get into it and you start realizing it, especially as more of these types of rules and regulations come into effect, how important it is both, you know, for day-to-day living and you know, the financial implications. Yeah. So let's get into it right now. Local Law 97. Alex, why don't you get into talking about what the requirements are of Local Law 97 and who's affected?
So, Local Law 97 at the highest level is a law that requires buildings 25,000 square feet and over to report their carbon emissions on an annual basis. The predecessor to this law was actually something called energy benchmarking. Many buildings will know it as Local Law 84. And the reason that Local Law 97 even plays a role in New York today is because building owners and managers have been submitting their energy data to the city for almost for over a decade. So the city knows how much energy is being used, but there wasn't an accountability mechanism. Meaning if you were a building that was using what might be determined to be too much energy, benchmarking, while it still exists today, didn't have a means of enforcing change. So the whole point of Local Law 97 is meant to incur action and to catalyze change. So for buildings over Local Law 97, what this requires is actually pulling in an energy information that stems from benchmarking, and I'm sure we'll speak about that later, looking at it in the context of total building gross floor area, the total size, and determining how much carbon is being expended for that building. Simply put, if the amount of carbon is over the limit that is prescribed for it, there will be a fine. And on top of that, the amount of carbon that buildings are allowed to use will reduce every 5 years. So that even while 33% of buildings in New York City right now are likely to face fines, that number is going to double, if not more, starting in 2030, when the amount of carbon that buildings are allowed to use decreases.
So, you read about these things. I don't know how well versed our audience is, but essentially there seems to be two camps, right? There's an Article 320 versus an Article 321 buildings. So can you explain for us, how do you know where you fit? How do you know if, say, for example, I'm a building owner and maybe I do meet that threshold of the size of the square footage. What how do I know where to go and which camp I'm in?
So the easy answer is there is a source of truth that the Department of Buildings publishes called the Covered Building List. And on the Covered Building List is every building 25,000 square feet and over with the path that they're supposed to follow. Now, unfortunately, life isn't always simple. And as comprehensive as this list from the Department of Buildings is, there may be buildings that are excluded, and therefore it becomes up to the owner or the manager of that building to determine where they fit. For most buildings, 25,000 square feet and over, the requirement is to begin filing these annual carbon emission reports starting this May 1st. Then there are different levels or there are different pathways to compliance that are based on the composition of the unit types of the buildings. When we get into buildings that have 1 to 35% of all units as rent regulated or rent stabilized, even though they have to report annual emissions, there's a little bit of leeway and they don't need to start reporting annually until 2027. They have 2 years as a break. There are some buildings where, if there is at least one unit that is income restricted, they actually don't even need to report until 2036. But the largest group in New York City, other than that initial one, which is the annual filing, is the group of buildings that are designated fully as affordable buildings or houses of worship. Now they have two different paths. Either A, the emissions that they have are already below the allowance that they have in 2030, meaning they are so efficient already that they are under compliance for the next 5 years and therefore for the next 10 years under 2030. Or if their emissions are not in compliance for 2030, there is a series of energy measures that they have to undertake. So in that first example, if a building does have to, or excuse me, if a building has its emissions below the 2030 level, all they need to submit is one report. As a reminder, this applies to buildings that are designated as affordable or have 35% or more rent-regulated units. They have to submit a one-time report. If an affordable building does have emissions that are projected to be over the 2030 limit, there is a more rigorous option where they need to complete 13 very specific, what are called prescriptive energy conservation measures. Unfortunately, if you fall into this camp, there is going to be some extent of capital investment required in order to get your building to comply with the law. Whereas under that first example that we spoke about for Local Law 97, that does not exist. So the very first step that every building should take is understanding what path they need to follow. And the Department
Right.
of Buildings has been quite strict, saying that to use the idiom that buildings need to stay in their lane, and if there's a path that's prescribed for them, they're not able to do another one.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, even at the initial starting point, right? I mean, you could get off to a false start here, and then you're taking the wrong pathway, and you may think, a building owner may think, hey, I'm a 321 article 321 building where, I have some rent regulated tenants, or I may be subjected to that different path. And then lo and behold, I don't have to do anything right now, potentially, or my requirements are much less. But in reality, you could be, that might not be the case. And then, you're facing some potentially very steep fines, right? So I think, as you said, every building is like a snowflake here, where, as an owner or as a landlord, of a portfolio or even a specific building of a certain size, there's a lot of information that you got to get, and you got to get it right. Otherwise, you're facing some difficulties, right?
Yeah, it's I speak to property managers, owners, executives all day, and the overwhelming sentiment in New York City right now is frustration. And it's hard. I mean, as if the energy issue wasn't enough. Obviously, insurance costs are skyrocketing. You've got taxes as another issue. There's some arguable extent of economic uncertainty going on. But at the end of the day, the way to get above or get ahead Local Law 97 is really through good data practice. If we were to strip away the energy component of this, and we were just to think of this as another compliance requirement for the city, the way to handle this is to have someone, whether it is someone on your board or an external energy partner, who's going to look at the information and make sure that what's submitted to the city is accurate.
Right.
That's really the way that a building can avoid the fear and the uncertainty, because I understand it seems like an overwhelming task. It is complicated by the fact that the matter at hand, energy and carbon, is not something that people are spending their days thinking about all the time. But really, the data is where buildings need to start.
So, I mean, I think you hit on an interesting and important topic there, right, Alex? So, I would imagine that the genesis of this whole thing is, like you said, you have to have the right data. Now, and it's all based upon benchmarking. So I would imagine, I've foreseen for a lot of potential building owners, and even our audience right now, where, this was probably an issue during COVID, where, you have Con Ed doing meter readings, and they're doing estimations, right? I mean, that's got to be a big problem, because then it snowballs from there.
You nailed it. That was actually, I remember going through benchmarking that summer. And just to expand on that point, Devin, for the audience, what we saw during that period was obviously Con Edison couldn't send people to read meters. Mind you, 5 years afterwards, there are actually smart meters in Con Edison territory that are gathering this information accurately without physical human intervention. But at this point, that didn't exist. So
Right.
because of that, Con Edison would send out, or they would take estimated reads based on what they thought was used. Eventually, after they were able to send their meter readers out, they would take an actual read. They were able to reverse engineer essentially what was used in those COVID months. And then they went through a process of canceling the old bills and issuing new ones. Now that sensibly makes a lot of sense. That's what any company would do. But
Sure.
when it came to benchmarking, what we saw was that the benchmarking system didn't know how to cancel the prior readings. So what it looked like from an energy perspective was that during COVID, these buildings were using twice as much energy as they had regularly. Fortunately, the Department of Buildings, from what we've been told in the latest series of updates, is aware of this and they are changing this. But it just goes to your point, Devin, that the energy usage really needs to be verified and scrutinized before anything gets submitted to the Department of Buildings.
Right. Okay, so now that we've kind of touched upon the initial framework of potential pathways and whatnot, I want to talk about some of the hot stuff, the hot topics, right? The upcoming deadlines and details on the
Topic.
filing process.
Okay.
And I think also, I don't want to say it's breaking news, but there were some important updates from the Department of Buildings, I think, over the last week or so, during one of their webinars concerning filing deadlines and extensions and who can file for extensions. So I'll let you start out on the initial deadlines, and then we can talk up and go through there.
Well, I'm going to use what you said. I think they are very much breaking news. These are big updates for the buildings of New York. And frankly, to be honest, it's good news. I think that's the most important message to communicate. The hottest news, if you will, is the fact that initially, for the past 4 or 5 years since Local Law 97 was first introduced, the deadline that has been announced for those annual reports is May 1st. So the city's done two things actually to make this a little bit more flexible. Number one, they have given everyone another 60 days of grace period to submit the Local Law 97 report without any penalties whatsoever. So hypothetically, someone could submit that report on June 30th, and they will comply fully without any repercussions. Now, on top of that, let's suppose that your building is going through one of the other pathways we talked about, the prescriptive pathway, where you are not filing every year, but you're filing once, and you do have to complete these 13 different energy measures. And let's suppose that you, since finding this out, have been in the process of lining up engineers and contractors, doing site visits, and there might be some work to do. If that is the case, then the building has the opportunity to submit its report an additional 60 days later, so not June 30th, but actually August 29th. Frankly, if you're a building that, let's say you're a single building condo or commercial building, you don't necessarily have to wait until that time. If for whatever reason you feel or there are prevailing circumstances that might lead you to take that time, then you can. But the point is that there is this big flexibility for buildings to take up till August 29th. What's required there is submitting an extension request, and the extension request has to come before June 30th. So just to make sure that was clear, June 30th is available to everyone. If you want even more time, then the extension request has to be submitted to the city by June 30th as well.
And I think one of the distinguishing changes, right, is that initially it was rolled out that you could get an extension, but you had to show that you were contracted up with a registered design professional by February 1st. Is that right?
Yes.
So, it was funny because I was getting, I think I got an email alerts from the Department of Buildings maybe a week or two before the deadline. Hey, by the way, if you haven't already, and you haven't unpacked all this stuff, you should have a contract with a design professional already. You should retain somebody and to avail yourself of that extra time. So
Right. There is that. So you're right. There is that requirement this time around as well. But fortunately, anyone who got those emails in February, the Department of Buildings has waved their magic wand, and they've said that it's possible for anyone to get that extension. So yeah, I think, frankly, I think this is a lot of relief from the Department of Buildings. And I can tell you, Devin, and I can tell all the listeners that from everything we've seen from the recent announcements, the process does look incredibly straightforward. I was, I've been in the industry for quite a while, and I was a little bit skeptical, but the city admittedly has put a lot of resources towards trying to make this as straightforward as possible. There will always be one-off situations or complications, but for most buildings in New York, I actually think rest assured that they'll find the process to be relatively simple. It's really just taking that first step.
But I think one of the things that I think the initial consensus was, as I mentioned at the top, this was the machinations of this came about before COVID. It was, and then right when we were immersed in that for the first 2.5+ years, people didn't really know about it, and then it was, well, this will never proceed. There's no way, and this administration or that administration will take care of it. Although the way them, like you said, there was a fingers crossed. Let's, the Department of Buildings will wave that magic wand, and they never really did, right? I mean, it just they kept pulling away full steam ahead, and they've made some sort of concessions here and there, but it's here to stay.
It's very much here to stay. And I think, the bigger picture that New York is pursuing, aside from the fact that they have goals to reduce emissions, there's going to be so much more electricity demand. I think it's almost inconceivable. For the past 10 years, almost 20 years, electricity demand in America was pretty flat. And even if we go back farther than that, before the advent of the air conditioning in America, it was also flat. Once the AC was invented, you had a huge spike in electricity across America and then across the world. And we're at a similar inflection point with the phrase that everyone hears nonstop on a daily basis, AI driving energy demand higher. But New York, like many other places, is going to face higher demand in computing power and also higher demand in electric vehicles. So you're going to have more consumption that's happening. So what the city is really trying to do beyond reducing their emissions is they're trying to act because they know that they need to make sure that there's enough power available for the city. That raises its own, people will weigh in on that in different ways. But I think that aside from the environmental or the civic issue, the political issue, there's also a question of safety and just energy resiliency that they're trying to address.
Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about, Alex, is penalties. That's the hook, right? I mean, okay, that's great. Energy, benchmarking, filing dates, but what's that mean to me, right? I'm an owner. I may have a covered building. I don't know. Maybe I do, maybe I don't. But I think it's important to really touch upon the fact that there are pretty extensive penalties, and it's to the extent that if you're over your greenhouse gas emissions cap or for late filing. So why don't you talk about that? And I think it's another mechanism from the Department of Buildings and the city that really puts some teeth into this thing that this is not something you can ignore, and there's something that and it's not something that's going to go away.
I'll talk about the late filing fee first, because one of my top priorities for all my clients is, especially with these extended deadlines, no one should be filing late. I mean, I really don't want to leave anyone behind, and no one should feel like they have to go about this alone either. If a building hypothetically were to extend, or excuse me, if they were to miss not only the June 30th deadline, but somehow they were to apply for the August 29th deadline, get accepted for it, and still miss it, they're looking at a fine of 50 cents per square foot per month, which is an astronomical amount per month. But again, I want to make sure, and all buildings should make sure, that given this flexibility, they shouldn't end up in that territory. Now, when it comes to the carbon fines themselves, the way that the fines are calculated are specific based on the energy that's being used at a building, and the types of space that are at a building. So there are a few different ways that buildings can make sure that they're not paying a cent more than they should. The first way is they want to check the energy usage. And this goes back to what we were talking about, Devin, an energy benchmark. They want to make sure that there are no funky looking data entries from Con Edison, or if they're an Attleboro's National Grid for gas. All this information, excuse me, comes in automatically. It flows into a system called Portfolio Manager, which is used for energy benchmarking. But buildings should make sure that all of that is accurate, because the last thing they want is to be fined for energy that they haven't used. The second piece is all about square footage. So the Department of Finance actually is the keeper of square footage for buildings in New York. If you were to look up any building, The square footage figure is technically from the Department of Finance. But Local Law 97 is using a different kind of metric than the Department of Finance. And they're using a metric called gross floor area, which includes things like hallways, basement space, elevator shafts, pipe shafts. And the Department of Finance doesn't always include all of that square footage in their metric. The reason this is important for Local Law 97 is you actually want your building to capture the most amount of space possible. And mathematically, if you think about energy efficiency, it's really a measurement of energy as the numerator and square footage as the denominator.
I'm
So
going
all
back to grade school math here. Hold on. Okay.
right. And
Crash.
by the way, I was not a math major, but this is simple enough math that even a non-math person could get there.
Right. I'm with you.
If you have a building that's using the same amount of energy, but all of a sudden it's determined that someone was not including additional square footage, what that means is the building's actually more efficient than it was perceived to be because it's taking the same amount of energy and supporting the same amount of building functions with that amount. So what we've seen for many buildings, probably I would like to say 50 to 60% of all buildings in New York City, again, this is not their fault, but the square footage that they've been reporting is what the Department of Finance says. And the challenge there is that number one, for Local Law 97, there has to be real proof of what the square footage is. It can't just be reporting the Department of Finance number and saying, well, this is what the DOF says it is. It has to be independently verifiable. And on top of that, if it turns out that your building is actually larger than it's reported to be, you will immediately see a decrease in not only potential fines for this current year, but in the future. I'll say one more thing about square footage, which is really unique. We were working with a building in Midtown. It's a mixed-use building, but they've got a dentist's office on the ground floor. Local Law 97 assigns different limits of carbon to different types of space. And there are technically 60 different types of space, everything from a cafe and a restaurant to family space to a military barracks to university, countless types. This building was classifying its dentist's office as a commercial office. And the problem there was that a commercial office is allowed to use less carbon than a dentist's office. So what we found was that the building actually looked like it had fines because it was misreporting what that actual office space was. And because dentists offer life-saving equipment and have more allowance under Local Law 97, just by changing that space type, we were able to reduce those 97 fines.
I think that's pretty incredible because, as you said, the positive is that there are allotments, right, for certain types of uses, right? It's not just one size fits all. But having said all that, it's a lot of data, it's a lot of energy to go through. And I think that's where, if I'm a building owner and if I have commercial tenants, like you said, they should be hopefully sub-metered, right? But sometimes there's mistakes, sometimes there's miscalculations. And that's where, that's where you would call somebody like Alex at Logical Buildings, where they can go through this stuff and they can make sure, A, that the input is correct. Because, it's if it's not right coming in, it's not going to be right coming out.
It's again, this is not something that buildings should have to do alone because this is onerous work. And if you're a condo or co-op in New York City, again, I recognize going back to that original point, you've got bigger things or equally big things on your mind than just energy. But the way to do this right is to have someone just go through the information. And best comes, either worst case scenario or best case scenario, depending on how you phrase it, someone comes back to you and says your building has all of its energy information exactly right. That's what you want. You want confirmation that everything looks good and that the inputs that are being sent to the city are correct. That's how you know that you're not paying a cent more than you should.
And I think also, one of the things we've been counseling our clients on is to make sure that they're aware of the requirements and the obligations. And, having said that, as you mentioned, each building is a snowflake. It's this unique portfolio, this unique characteristic where one size does not fit all. And it takes individual review and touch. But I think one of the main points that I can recommend as a owner or landlord is to talk to your commercial tenants. I mean, you want to figure out if you're going to be facing a penalty for exceeding emissions caps, so that tenants are aware that this is coming down. I mean, we're trying to, from a legal standpoint, whether we're dealing with it in our lease amendments during renewal periods to reflect these obligations and spell out who's responsible for what and their fair share. Again, just so you're avoiding or just being proactive to avoid other legal issues or ramifications down the road. But even from your perspective in the initial side, I think it's imperative, as you said, that they shouldn't go through this alone because there's a lot. And someone like you, Alex, in your firm, it's immensely helpful where they have a partner and somebody that they can help go through all this and help them understand it. Like even though it is straightforward, as you said, to an extent, right? I mean, I was on those webinars and I'm looking at even just trying to navigate the separate, I don't want to get into the nerd stuff here, but the separate website, the reporting, the Beam technology. I mean, there's a lot there.
Right. And honestly, Devin, what I've been telling people is they really, if they hire a good, what's called a registered design professional, they shouldn't have to worry about it. One of
Right.
the most important thing from the webinar, aside from the extension of the deadlines, was the fact that this process starts through the Department of Buildings DLB Now website, and how buildings essentially, even before someone can get started in the process, they have to pay their filing fees to be able to complete the work.
Right.
But what I've been telling clients is that they've hired us for a reason, or they've hired other energy partners for a reason. Aside from periodic questions that we might bring to them regarding their square footage or their energy data, they shouldn't have to be doing this. It is, again, this is incredibly complex, even for for engineers, not necessarily to gather the information, but to make sure it's submitted in a cohesive fashion. Even though that the platform that they put forward can be relatively simple, but buildings shouldn't have to be going through that platform. What essentially I am trying to accomplish with our clients is to let them know that once they take care of their filing fees, which is the element that kicks off the process, they shouldn't have to worry about the other platforms. Of course, we'll keep them in the loop and we'll let them know what's required, but hiring a registered design professional, an RDP, which is required under Local Law 97, means that a lot of those tasks shouldn't be on their shoulders.
Yeah, I think that's a you're absolutely right there. I mean, again, if because I you think about it, even if the information is incorrect, longer term, my concerns are that there are penalties also for quote unquote filing false statements, right? False certifications, and in the past, this kind of comes up in other avenues, but my concern would be too is that if the information's incorrect, either you're not availing yourselves of a potential benefit of an extension, or you may be paying more than you need to, or even worse, you're subjected to additional fines down the road. Really quick, I just want to talk about, we can tease this a little bit, but there are some. And this goes to what you were saying before about having a registered design professional or RDP to help you in the beginning, but there are some possibilities, right, for potential mitigation or good faith efforts, as they call it. But I want to talk to you and ask you about this because again, it's not the way this has been rolled out, unlike all the other scenarios with the Department of Buildings, is that in this case, it all has to be done up front. It's a unique situation where it's not, I failed to comply, and okay, I'm gonna beg for mercy. This has to be all done up front, right?
So the way that the city is administering this process is once someone goes through the Local Law 97 calculation of figuring out how much carbon they've used, it's up to them to then figure out, okay, well, are we over the limit or are we under? If they determine that they're over the limit, This is when they essentially have to make an appeal. Now, because there is no precedent for this, we don't exactly know how the Department of Buildings is going to react. But the appeal is, like you said, Devin, through this good faith efforts extension, which essentially is showing that the building is going to take its utmost efforts to remove penalties in the future. So aside from submitting compulsory reports like the energy benchmarking report, the actual Local N97, meaning even if you are over the limit, you still need to submit, excuse me, that you've done the report, and the Local Law 88 report, which is a one-time compliance item for buildings to verify their lighting and their submetering. The other element that's incumbent here is a decarbonization plan. So it does require, like you said, upfront thought into if we want to get to the position where we are able to get penalties reduced, how are we putting that argument forward? And I'm certainly no lawyer, but in a way, it's basically like stating one's case before the judge and the jury, with the Department of Buildings saying, okay, what is X building saying that they're going to do to reduce their emissions? And based on this testimony, the Department of Buildings may lessen the fines that are incumbent upon that building.
Absolutely right, Alex. I mean, and this may be something we can talk about on a later show if we dive into the good faith efforts requirements and whatnot. But real quick, as we start to wrap up, if I'm a building owner here, and I'm thinking, hey, I'm sitting pretty here under the 2024, 2025 emissions cap limits. So, what's the big deal? But there's the second phase, if you want to just real briefly talk about this, that it's going to continue to go up, right? I mean, it's not just going away this one time. It's every 5 years it keeps stepping up.
At the risk of scaring away your viewers or your listeners right now, Local Law 97 is a 25-year law. It's supposed to go until 2050. And like you said, every 5 years, the limits are going to intensify. So at some point in time, buildings are probably looking at some sort of fine. And it really comes down to how proactive the buildings want to be. So going back to your earlier point, yes, they should absolutely have conversations with their commercial tenants, even just to educate them. I'm sure a lot of the tenants, because they aren't necessarily in the position of ownership or management, they may not even know about these things. We are aware of it because we're in it all the time, and owners and managers are expected to keep up with the litany of different compliance laws. But a lot of it is just education, explaining to people what's happening, why this is important, and why it includes them. And then it just becomes an acknowledgement of the fact that, unfortunately, there's no silver bullet in energy. I wish there were. I wish you could hire one firm to do one thing that solves everything and it's happily ever after. That it, buildings are incredibly complex, so unfortunately, the solutions have to be complex. The way to start this process is thinking, if you're speaking to a co-op or condo and you know that the owners and the shareholders have held these assets for a long time, they want these assets to be around for their children, their grandchildren, and arguably it could be the most valuable asset that they hold financially. It's about showing them that if this is something worth keeping and investing in long term, there need to be these long term solutions. So even if 2025 looks good, if 2030 looks good, eventually in 2035, it's important for buildings to start mapping out their course of action, to start thinking about what do we know can be done, what do we know cannot be done, and start having conversations. Those buildings have the luxury of time. There are others that do not. But if your building is one of the ones that has the luxury of time, either because you don't have fines on the immediate horizon, or because you might have, if you're a condo or co-op, you might have affordable units or income restricted units, and you don't have to file until later, it doesn't necessarily excuse you from the due diligence process. And there are lots of different, platforms, technologies, solutions out there that your building should start exploring to see what works best.
Exactly, Alex. I mean, it's something that's not going away, whether it's 2024 or 5 years down the road or 5 years after that. Like you said, it's a multi-decade issue here, and there's going to have to be some real conversations if you're either a building owner or a condo, a co-op, where this is going to be something that has to be dealt with. I think we've just kind of scratched the surface here, and there's a ton to unpack, but perhaps for another episode or two down the road, but we can tackle some of these things in more detail. But I think essentially, if you're an owner of a large mixed-use building, this is very much going to be an issue for you in the upcoming years, as we said. And you shouldn't have to go it alone because there's a lot of issues here at the front stage and then at the back end too, where the initial components are very critical because they could have longer lasting effects. So, one of the things I would recommend is you contact Alex at Logical Buildings to discuss a strategy and figure out whether this affects you, as well as contacting me or your trusted Rosenberg and Estes attorney to talk about this and figure out how we can deal with this that makes the most sense, whereas short term and long term. Are you a covered building? Have you filed? Are you over your allotment? How can we get in compliance? Are you facing penalties? How can we help lower this? So, Alex, why don't you just briefly provide a contact information where we can reach you? I know it's going to be in the show notes, but you want to just broadcast it out to our listening audience.
Sure. Everyone, feel free to reach out. Azafran, Zafran, at logicalbuildings.com. I want to make sure that, like you said, Devin, you're not alone. If you've got an energy partner that you trust, that's great. But if there are questions or the beginnings of discussions that are happening about Local Law 97 or any energy related issues to your building, which Devin, maybe we can talk about at a different episode as well.
Think so.
We want to be a resource.
All right, great, Alex. This has been super informative. Again, I am the host. I am Devin Kosar. I can be reached at 212-551-1208 or by email at dkosar@rosenbergestes.com. This has been another edition of Inside R&E. I am Devin Kosar, and thanks again for joining us today.